Dear Shooter, sometimes what seems like a natural evolution in life just doesn't work out. One example, military. You've seen things or done things that can't be unseen. Your term is up. 25% of those see law enforcement as the next evolution. But does that help you heal? Or does it make you keep your baggage tucked away? Today we talk to James Weck, military, law enforcement, and now a law student.
It's not about protecting the stupid, it's just, it is what it is.
I don't know if you know this, but I'm a self-identifying llama. and it's because I have a quick temper and I like to spit.
You are not safe and you are not sacred and you're both liars.
We're talking about firearms, y'all. Keep it clean.
I can hide one under there.
One what? I want to know.
I looked like I got ran over by a paint truck on the way to Sherwin-Williams and then backed over by the short bus.
You know, let's talk about the modern trends in transsexual transitions.
Welcome to the Dear Shooter podcast. Dear Shooter is brought to you by WyoTech, empowerment through self-reliance, and by Lucid Optics, on target, under budget.
All right, and that music means it's Thursday, so that means it's time for Dear Shooter. And I'm here with my co-host, Jason Wilson, Brandy Crotto, and we have a special guest in-house, James Weck.
And he is special, yes.
Now, here's a man who's had a very interesting career. Went into the Army, served in the 10th Mountain Division, came out of there and became a Wyoming Highway Patrol state trooper, and now is a second-year law student. And I got to say, I'm extremely curious of someone who's lived definitely a Second Amendment lifestyle, how you got from there to here.
Yeah, so, well, there was a lot of window licking along the way, and, you know, decisions that I thought were great that probably were still not terrible, but...
Well, you met well.
Yeah, I had the best idea at the time, right? So, you know, I graduated high school in 2004. The global war on terrorism was in a full swing, and I was that idealistic true believer that thought we were doing all the right and just things that we needed to do to delete the bad guys in the world. And I was going to be a part of it.
And I like the way you put that, deleting bad guys.
I like it.
You know, we gotta dehumanize things. Makes it easier to deal with it, right? That's what all of, you know, the training's all about, right? So I go into the Army and I end up at Fort Drum, New York with the 10th Mountain Division and landed at the 1st 87th Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division. That was in the spring of 2005 when I finally got there. I spent a little bit longer in TRADOC down at Fort Benning. I broke my foot a couple times, first time in basic, second time at jump school, so I never got my jump wings. You want to see an 18-year-old kid with a broken heart, tell him he's never going to get to jump out of a plane. That'll do it. So I end up at Fort Drum, and I spent 4.5 years on a 3-year contract up in the Army, deployed twice to Iraq, got out of that, went on to get my bachelor's degree. I was living in Ohio at the time, and towards the end of completion on my bachelor's, saw an ad on Facebook one day that said Wyoming Highway Patrol hiring. And my family lived in Wyoming when I was younger and I wanted to move back. And so I gave it a try. First time I went out to interview in 2011, I got all the way through the interview process and ran into a brick wall at the psych evaluation.
HR sucks.
Well, they seem to think that I was high risk, and there's probably some truth to that at that time.
Anger management issues?
Oh, maybe a few. You know, and the thing is that back then when you were coming out of the military, even coming off deployments, the screening was terrible. I've heard it's not any better today. You'd get back and they'd say, you know, do you have any signs or symptoms of PTSD? Default answer, no.
Because you don't want labels.
Yes.
Right.
Right. All right.
You know, they're going to start deep diving into your head. You're going to start seeing things that you don't want to see, dealing with stuff you don't want to deal with. And you're probably going to come off the line. And nobody wants that. So I had a lot of stuff that I hadn't dealt with and really didn't start dealing with it till a couple of years ago. But that's another conversation. And it's one that needs to happen. Because there's guys from that world have an aversion to dealing with the negatives,
right.
You know, dealing with the trauma. And it may not even be trauma that you eat personally, but you see it, you observe it. You know, some of the things that bothered me the most in Iraq were the things that I saw human beings could do to other human beings. You know, it wasn't even like, you know, the insurgents trying to kill us. Like, that was just business. It was seeing the other atrocities committed mm-hmm. against people.
Right.
You know, that it's ugly. So that stuff you don't get to unsee. And so, yeah, so I had things that I had to deal with, and the patrol told me, go deal with your stuff. Come back. They liked everything else they saw. They just wanted me to get my mental shit in order. So I spent the next year doing work, getting my anger quasi under control. Came back 2012, went through the process, made it past the psychologist, you know, thank God. They offered me a job, and I packed up and moved out to Wyoming.
Now, I find it interesting that you just addressed all the reasons that you avoid the negative pieces in life, and then you chose a profession that's all you deal with.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, so I really loved the infantry. I loved what we were doing. I loved running around with my friends. You know, just, it was chaos, but I just, there's some sick twisted thing about that world. And you throw 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, 22-year-old kids in it. And I do mean kids. Like, I look back at 21-year-old me. I was an E5 leading a fire team in the infantry, and look, I was a kid. Like,
I actually have the photo of you. You're deployed, and you're sitting in some downtime, and yes, you look very young.
I look 12. I mean,
I've always kind of wondered that. I think a lot of the problems that we have with the PTSD and stuff is they send these kids into situations that they're not emotionally prepared to deal with.
You know, I don't think it's that they're not emotionally prepared to deal with it. It's that they're not taught how to ask for help after the fact.
That's right. A good point.
You know, like my therapist that I deal with right now, I told her one day, I said, you know, I should have gotten help years ago. And she flat looked at me and she said, nobody taught you how. They taught you how to do all these things. Nobody taught you how to ask for help, you know.
And as men in this country, we're conditioned to not ask.
We really are. And, you know, you learn to compartmentalize things, you know, or it crushes your soul.
Right.
You know, and I didn't realize how good I was at compartmentalizing things until the wheels came off the bus about 3 years ago. And the really interesting thing, and I really advocate for all of my first responder friends, my military friends, everybody go to therapy early, because what happened to me, I watched one of our dogs die. I watched him tip over and die in our back porch. That, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't stop it. He was dying, you know, and I couldn't handle, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And all of that, all of the years of compartmentalized shit hit me like a ton of bricks at once. And it wrecked me. Even to this day, like, I can't compartmentalize things like I used to. Like, I can't just stuff things in boxes anymore because it doesn't exist.
You think that's because your boxes are full?
No, we've been emptying boxes.
Okay, all right.
But that part of my psyche, that ability, it's wrecked.
Gotcha. Well, and that's one of the things that never really gets talked about. Like, there's so much stuff going on, especially with law enforcement, and it's that adversarial relationship that's been created. But what I think most people don't understand is you spend your entire day, like, that is your job, is to deal with the worst parts of society, people having their worst day.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I think a lot of people, they don't, that, you know, if you have an interaction with a law enforcement officer, anyone who does, who isn't an officer or a trooper or a deputy, it's an isolated incident for them.
Mm-hmm.
For that officer, it is one of thousands. And in that one of thousands, even if your interaction is just a traffic stop, that one of thousands includes crashes and fatalities, crimes against other people that are horrendous. You know, you are dealing with terrible things on a daily basis. It's never a good day for the people you're dealing with. And that is emotionally draining. You know, I wouldn't say that it was, you know, the psychological aspect that the things I saw in Iraq were, like, it's not on the same level. It's emotionally taxing differently. It just drains your compassion. It drains your empathy. It drains your, you know, it really moves you in an apathetic direction.
Well, let's face it. I mean, the world that we're living in today, even the United States, it's not Mayberry anymore.
No.
Well, and I had a front row seat to most of your trooper career here in Wyoming, and some of my most beloved stories, which are finding humor in an absolute horrific situation, come from James Weck trooper stories. and I know you didn't tell me everything. I know that you dealt with some funny stuff, and you dealt with some horrible stuff that you treated with humor to try and figure out how to work with it.
You know, and it's funny because, like, yeah, I mean, there were times where we would be sitting on a fatal crash scene for hours, waiting for a crash investigator to come, GPS the whole scene, do all that. And we're looking at this terrible thing that just happened. And there's two things you can do. You can sit there and you can let the ugliness just eat your soul. Or you find other things that are unrelated to it that are hilarious that you can divert your attention to. And, you know, there were times that we would talk after a scene where somebody would come up on the scene and we were having a laugh and they would think that we're laughing about the crash. We know that's what they're thinking because that's the isolated incident to them. But we're laughing about something that happened days, weeks, months ago. Mm-hmm. You know, something so far removed from this that one of us did that was stupid, or that we ran into somebody that just really liked to just make hard choices in life. And, you know, that was the humor element. You know, the humor was never in the actual event itself, because, you know, there's nothing funny about those scenes, you know, but you have to find ways to get your mind off of the ugly shit you're dealing with.
Now, one of the things that you did as a trooper that I always kind of found fascinating, you were the high-speed chase guy.
So this guy can drive.
I've only been in two, and
he can drive.
Thanks, Jason. you know, I don't know shit about cars, but they told me to get in the car and drive, and I could drive, so we're good.
I don't need to know the details of a penny to understand how money works.
Right.
Just real quick, I watched video from, I think, the cam in your car.
Was that when I took the ditch?
You took the ditch because it was a life-saving move. You avoided a crash. You took mm-hmm. the ditch at a very high rate of speed. He maintains control of the vehicle, picks up enough sagebrush to start his car on fire, but still maintains the chase for quite some time.
Yeah, so I was in a chase, and I was young enough in my career that the arrogance was just in full display. I'm sitting on this guy's ass going 117 miles an hour down the highway, and I could read his license plate, you know, and it was this, where are you going to go now mentality? You know, I'm here. You have a V6 Dodge Charger. I have a V8 Dodge Charger. You're not getting away from me. And it was, I didn't realize how fast I'd reacted in this situation until I saw the video. And, you know, it's one of those things, anticipation, you know, reading your environment, all those things come into play. Sure. And I, we've got this downhill, what was for the, there was a tractor trailer coming down this hill towards us, and it was a downhill right, left to right curve for him. And as he's coming down, I said to myself, I said, this guy's going to try and run that tractor trailer off the road to try to crash him so we discontinue this pursuit. I thought, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen right here? That's it. As soon as the guy that I was chasing broke left to run that tractor trailer, I'd already done the mental work, you know, and this goes into anticipating your environments. I'd already done the mental work. And you watch it on video, it looked choreographed. He broke left, I broke right. And I took the ditch, I found the delineator post at 117 miles an hour and split them. Take it all the way down to the bottom of the ditch. Level it out in the bottom of the bar ditch. Sagebrushes flying everywhere. I've got control of my car. I look left. They never crashed. Tractor trailer's still upright. I steer my car back to the highway and re-engage. I get a few miles down the road, and I start smelling this very distinct smell of burning. And I very quickly realized that my car's on fire.
Well, you were cleansing your car of the demons, a little sage burning.
From,
I mean,
bumper to bumper.
This was the second time he'd used his fire extinguisher in a week.
Yeah, the first time was accidental. It so right after I picked up my, so this was my first Dodge Charger. Before that, I had a Chevy Impala V6, which was a gutless wonder. And so I get this V8 Dodge Charger that'll just run. And I go to see how much ass it's really got. And so when you go down and you swap your vehicles, you only take the bare minimum. So you take your medical bag, you take your fire extinguisher, you take all the things you need for an emergency, and that's it.
Right.
Well, I throttled it to see how much get up and go it had. Turns out the pin had dropped out of my fire extinguisher. The handle was facing the rear of my car. It slides to the back of the trunk and goes full discharge in the trunk of my car. All I see is smoke coming out of the trunk of my car. I think my car's on fire. This is before I actually caught my car ever on fire. And like, I'm pulling over as fast as I can be, and I'm like, well, I just nuked my Dodge Charger. No, it's just a fire extinguisher. I opened the trunk, saw the fire extinguisher, white dust all over the place, closed the truck, got back in, and drove away. And someone who knew me saw it happen.
Welcome to Wyoming.
I was down in Cheyenne. I didn't tell a soul about it. And one of the guys I worked with came to me and said, heard your fire extinguisher went off. I have no idea who saw it. I still, to this day, nobody's ever told me.
It's Wyoming.
This, for example, is why some of my best stories that I love and hold dear are James Weck Trooper stories.
Oh, yeah.
His career is littered with things just like this.
I remember him telling me a story about a guy he pulled over, and the guy was just a bad driver. And you ended up pulling his CDL because he was so arrogant with you.
I dared
you to write him a ticket.
Yes.
So there wasn't a CDL involved in that one that Jason just referenced. I did have a guy, I tried to give a warning, reject the warning, and told me to go write the ticket. I obliged. You know, I mean, who am I to not give a citizen of Wyoming what they're asking for? And so, and the killer was, is that I didn't even care about the guy. I was traveling in the opposite direction of him. I got a radio call that told me there were cows out on South Pass, which is between Lander and Rock Springs in Wyoming, and it's a mountain pass. There's cows out. Got to go put the cows up. That's 40% of what a state trooper does in the state.
Oh, okay. So state trooper / rancher.
Yeah.
Keep the cows off the highway.
I learned how to fix fence. I carried my own stretchers. I carried my own pliers.
Whoever thought law enforcement would require fencing material?
Hours on end fixing fence because, like, it's a fence outstate, so we have to fence them off the highway.
Right.
And if they keep getting out, it's my problem over and over again. I didn't want to keep putting the same cows up, so I would fix the fence. I went out in a snowstorm one night. These cows busted the fence. I think I spent 2 hours in the snowstorm fixing the fence because the plow drivers were all plowing. There was nobody to fix the fence but me. Right. I'm out there with stretchers, stretching fence. Look, I'm not a rancher. Those guys deal with a heck of a lot harder stuff than I did in my 2 hours doing that. And I realized real quick there, ranching sucks.
So, all right, before we move on, one more that I think our listeners would really appreciate. You pulled over a guy that was going 7 miles an hour. And I believe his last name was Weed.
Oh. Yeah, I did arrest Weed, and he was high as a kite.
you pulled him over, and he assumed
I had forgotten about that. This guy, nice guy. He was real pleasant. Yeah, guy was higher than could be.
You pulled him over and walked up to his window, and he assumed that he was speeding.
I don't remember the context. It's funny. You must have gotten this from Jason because, you know, the thing is, like he was saying, like, there's so many of these.
Oh, God.
Like, I have forgotten most of them. And I didn't, I kick myself because I did not keep a good record. And there's, look, every.
I know, and you could write a book.
You know, and this is the thing is, every state trooper across the country could write a book. Like, every one of us, every deputy, like, every cop, because, like, we all come into so many just what the hell moments. You know, it's like, that was your good idea today? That one? That was the best thing you could come up with? You know, it's like the guy that told me to go right. I tried to give him a warning. He had lane use violation. I could tell he wasn't drunk. He was watching me in his rearview mirror. He thought I was going to pull him over. After watching him do that for 2 miles, you're right, I'm going to pull you over. You know? And then, like, I was like, look, man, whatever you're doing, stop doing. Just drive. Here's a warning. Tells me it was a bullshit traffic. I got 2 miles of you crossing every lane on the highway. I got no problems writing this ticket. I'm going to court all day long on this. You know?
But those experiences, dealing with the public like that, they don't want to see you, obviously.
Mm-mm.
Calloused, if you will, some of your give a shit, and makes everything boil down to first world problem, third world problem. And that's going to be very useful as you head towards a law degree.
Yeah, well, you know, even me, like the other day I told you, I went by a Riverton police person. Usually I don't make eye contact with them. I make sure I'm doing the right thing and just move on. But he took the time to wave at me. And I made a big deal out of that. I'm like, he waved at me. And that's maybe,
you know,
something.
And it's funny because, like, I know that he used to give me a hard time. Like, I'd never wave. And the thing is, I never saw him. I just saw cars, you know. Like, I didn't look at drivers, you know. It's like I didn't look at faces. I looked at cars. I looked at speed. I looked at registration. I looked at all these other things. He sent me, you know, a message later on. You know, I saw you today. You didn't wave. I'm like, never saw you. You know?
I would drive behind him. I would pass him. I'd get in front of him. I'd get out of the lane, get back behind him. He never saw me.
Saw a car.
Well, and this is one of the things that I've talked about a lot on this show. So law enforcement, you know, we talk about shooting, right? We talk about guns. We talk about shooting. Law enforcement, for everything that you do, The shooting part of it is like less than 1%. But it's that less than 1% that becomes the most important thing that you'll ever do.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was 0%.
Right.
I mean, you know, the thing is, I mean, most guys go their entire careers and never, you know, never exchange rounds with somebody else. But, you know, when that moment arises, like, if you do not have your A+ game,
right,
you're in trouble.
Right, and that's the critical dynamic, and it's kind of the hard thing with law enforcement is because you can only spend so much on training for an incident that, look, statistically, you are probably not ever going to encounter.
Right.
But if it does happen, like it, you're exactly right. You have to have your A-plus game.
You know, and it was funny for me, you know, I mean, I was still young. I was 26 when I got on with the patrol, and, you know, I was, oh, let me think. That was in 2012. I was just over 3 years removed from the Army, you know, about 4.5 years removed from my last mission, and I thought I was a good gunfighter. Like, I thought I was good, and then I started meeting some guys with badges who made me look like a chump, you know, and I realized we got ground to make up here. and you know, Jason knows that I really took that part of and the responsibility very seriously. And I, to the extent that, I mean, I was training on my own, and look, everybody has to do that. Like, one of my biggest gripes, you know, in the shooting world is that a lot of people think because they have a gun, they are dangerous and they are safe. And having a gun and knowing what to do with it are two very different things.
Yep.
And also there's the component of doing the mental work.
Right.
To deal with that day when it comes. And, you know, my biggest fear, you know, I had two fears. One was ego-driven and one was heart-driven. The heart-driven fear terrified me, and that was if I had somebody pull on me and I had to engage, that I would miss them and hit some little kid on a playground. Like, that was the scariest scenario to me. That scared me more than getting killed.
Right.
And because I couldn't live with that. You know, I could not live with that. The ego part was just the simple thought of losing, you know? And so, you know, I worked on my craft to the point where I knew I was proficient enough that unless someone got incredibly lucky, and lucky shots happen, unless they got incredibly lucky, the only group of people that were truly better than me were operators and you know, professional shooters, you know, people at that level.
And we say that in our training, you know, look, luck counts, but you can't count on luck.
I spend a lot of time on ranges with professional shooters. I spend a lot of time talking with law enforcement guys, sometimes on ranges. And I watched you take those two challenges on a personal level. And you trained yourself into a position where I don't know that I knew anybody that was more proficient and more professional with carrying than you.
I appreciate that.
But you took it seriously.
I really did.
You didn't just do the standard qualification and call that a day. You did not.
No, I didn't. And a lot of it was really driven about that fear of hitting the wrong person. You know, I wanted to be fast and accurate so that my chance of survivability was high, but so that the accuracy was always paramount in that I would hit what I intended to hit. And, you know, even during training, like, I took note of misses. They were not sloughed off. It was the, okay, why did it happen? How do we fix it? You know?
Well, and that's where the learning takes place. Mm-hmm. You don't learn from your hits. You learn from your misses.
You do.
That's right.
You really do. You know, and you know, and even to the extent of taking a pistol back 50, 7,500, 150 yards, you know, really working on, you know, accuracy, you know, is, you know, I've been on KD ranges out to 300 yards in various trainings where we kind of had like a free for all, you know, just take it, work on your skills, work on your things, you know, do what you want to do. I'm standing there with a pistol trying to ring 300, you know, because why not? You know, let's see how we can, you know, because everything comes into play there.
Three and a quarter, bitches.
You know, and
watched him do it. It was funny. But, I mean, that mindset, though, translates into decision-making. You spend a lot of time in your car working on yourself that way.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm that deep.
Well, I'm going to make you that deep because, again, I watched your law enforcement career from almost inception here in Wyoming to just about the end.
Yeah.
And everybody would ask, oh, man, this just happened. Who do I call? I'm like, well, James Weck. Why? I asked that question to myself a lot, because James would roll up on scene, ask what happened, get the whole story, and be fair about it.
Yep.
And it wasn't about burning you down. It was about, all right, what's the right decision here?
Well, and I'm a prime example of that.
I watched you do that time and time again.
I'm a prime example of that. I was coming home one night, and I crushed a freaking deer on the highway. And not really knowing what to do, because it was the first time I'd ever hit a deer, I'm like, well, crap, I got to report this so I can get my insurance and everything.
I remember that.
Who do I call? You know,
but
and
you
it
drove
was,
home first. And
I did, and I wasn't supposed to. But
you have to notify them at least and let them tell you to drive home that you hit one, or it's a hit and run.
Well, yeah. So
you know, I don't know a single trooper who's ever gotten twitchy with somebody because they drove home after hitting a deer. Because the last thing we wanted, and look, maybe they would. It's always great if you got cell phone coverage to call, ask, and say, hey, you know what? I can drive home. The deer's off the road. I can drive home. They can come to me at their convenience. We love that. Dear Lord, we've got so much stuff going on from call to call to call. Let me, if you're good and you're safe, then I can come to you at our convenience together.
And that's exactly how you handled it. I mean, when I called you, the first question you asked me, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. You know, I need a damage report so I can get my insurance.
Right.
You know, and that's all it was.
You know, and I really tried, and I think early in my career I had a more difficult time because I struggled to find the balance of, and I think a lot of young men do, you know, especially when you're in any kind of position of leadership or authority, of how do I handle this in a way where I maintain control, but then you have to find that way to do it without being a dick. And that takes time, experience, and maturity. And, you know, a lot, you know, older, wiser men are always trying to tell younger guys, you know, and the young guys are always like, you don't know what you're talking about, man. They do. You know, I remember my dad became really smart in my mid-20s. He was really dumb before that. And all of a sudden, in my mid-20s, he was one of the smartest human beings I knew. And you know, it took a long time. I know that there were a lot more people early in my career who thought I was a total prick than there were on the back end of my career. And that's just growing and learning and realizing, one, when I realized that as one of my friends calls it, my vibe, people... I don't have to assert authority. Once I realized that, things got easy.
Well, it's called personal growth.
It is. You know, and people knew when people would meet me, they knew I wasn't full of shit. They knew I wasn't weak. They knew I was going to conduct business. But I was also firm and fair about it. You know, and there's a lot of people, maybe some of them still live around here, some don't, who I would pull them over and I would talk to them. I'd tell them what compliance looks like. I would tell them that they are grown adults and they're going to make their own decisions. Here's door A. Door A is you don't comply. I make you a project. I pull you over every time I see you doing this. Door B is you just comply and I leave you alone. And one of the things I found is when you give people the freedom of choice, you don't impose your will on them. It's crazy. They want you to leave them alone.
Right.
Right.
So in the vein of that, I'm going to transition towards his legal.
Yes, that's where I was going.
So you're going to take these skills, obviously, as a foundation and apply them towards the law now.
Yeah.
There's always a reason that somebody's having a litigious issue.
Right.
And you have to navigate that from a position of, all right, what's the law say?
Right.
What's the situation?
Well, I mean, you got to go back even further. What's your real problem?
Right. Okay.
You know,
very
good. What happened? What's wrong? Okay. Then you get into, okay, well, what's the law on the matter? You know, and look, I'm not an attorney yet. Like I have a lot, because of my past experience, I have a lot of attorneys in my corner and I have a better network than I think most people going to law school do when they start. And that's been an advantage to me because I have a view into the window differently. But so, yeah, and then there's the human element.
Yeah, and so how would this transition that you're taking from law enforcement and applying the law in one aspect to now being a lawyer and having to apply it in a different way?
You know, it's interesting because I ask different questions now.
Ah.
You know, like back then, you know, I mean, I've been reading statutes since 2012, but I read them differently now.
Right.
You know, now it's the question of, okay, A, has this been interpreted by a presiding court that has jurisdiction that is binding? If it has been, then that is the interpretation. Okay, how do we apply it? You know, and then if it hasn't been, okay, well, what's the reasonable way to interpret this? You
right.
know, and versus on the other side, it was much less, there was a lot less thought about it. You know, it was a simpler reading of the terms. It was a simpler reading of the words. And, you know, I still gave it a pragmatic approach, but not to the depth that I look at it now.
So let me ask you this. In terms of going after your law degree, and you say that you interpret a lot of these things differently, would you agree that similarly to being a doctor, that being an attorney, that's the reason they call it a practice, because you are constantly looking at these laws and looking at the way they're interpreted, the way that they are brought down by the courts in terms of enforcement?
You know, I hadn't thought about it in that way. I think that's a pretty good way to articulate it. You know, and I think a lot of professions, you know, the learning doesn't stop, you know, in a lot of ways we're all practicing,
right?
You know, like we're all, you know, Jason, and what you're doing, you're always trying to get better at what you're doing, getting better at sales, getting better at your interactions with customers, getting better interactions with whoever it is you interact with in your community. You know, Jason, you know, every time I would expect that, you know, we've never been on the range together, but I would expect that you're out there every time trying to figure out, okay, did I communicate things well? How could I communicate things better? Did I, you know, how do I need to adjust things?
Mm-hmm.
We're all practicing.
Yep.
You know, we're all, if you're not still practicing, and when I say practicing, I mean, you're learning,
right?
You know, it's a training, it's being on the range and working on your draw stroke and working on your presentation, working on your trigger press and doing all these things. It's practice, it's training, it's continued learning. And I think you're right. Like the learning doesn't stop for any profession or any line of work when you get out of "quote unquote school,"
right? And we talk about that all the time. How, you know, it especially in the training community. Look, if you're not evolving, you're getting left behind.
Right.
So you're taking a natural transition of the tools of law enforcement, and transitioning to the tools of applying the law, right? So you had a gun and a badge before, and now you've got a pen and some paper.
Yeah.
And your writing's taking a paramount front.
It really has. Tool. It really has. You know, when I left that world behind, I really just said, "Look, I'm not a gunfighter anymore. I'm not going to live in the world of chaos anymore. I don't want to fight anymore. I don't have any desire for the chaos and all of that." And you know, we're moving into this world of the written word. And the crazy thing about it is I'm a numbers guy. I have never been a words guy. I've never been a heavy reader. I've never been, you know, I wrote, you know, when I look back to how I wrote in my undergrad or how I wrote in my master's or even how I wrote reports, they were fine. They, you know, but the way I write today is completely different and on a different level. But I have really devoted myself to that craft, you know, and not to say others don't, but in the same way that I approached my training as a trooper, I looked at that and said, let's become the best writer that I can be. You know, my weapon is words now.
And I don't think most people think about that in terms of like lawyers, right? Because they see the courtroom dramas and da-da-da-da. They don't understand that probably 90% of what you do is just writing.
It is so much research and writing, and I've done some work for attorneys, and it is, we have XYZ problem. go research it. You know, and researching means going and looking at the statutes, looking at case law, looking into, you know, all the places where the information is, and then applying that to the problem, mm-hmm. you know, and the fact pattern, whatever you have, and concluding all that. And you know, it's a, that is the process. You know, I've got a really good friend who is in, he's a plaintiff's attorney, he's in civil litigation. He was a prosecutor before that. He was in court all the time as a prosecutor. As a civil litigator, he is always working on his cases. He has yet to find his way into a courtroom. He is researching. He is writing. He is building his cases for his clients. You know, obviously there are, you know, agreements that are made, you know, and, but it's not in court all the time.
Right. Now, And I did that to kind of transition you into something. You wrote a paper on a bill that we actually discussed quite a bit on this program, and it was Wyoming House Bill 125, and this was the it was supposed to eliminate gun-free zones in Wyoming. Now it passed the House and the Senate. The governor vetoed it. You did a lot of research onto this. And you're kind of, if tell me if I'm wrong here, you agree with the veto.
Well, in the shortest answer, yes. And I'd like to say, like, you know, I've done a lot of research. Yes, I've done a lot of reading on this because there's a lot of hoopla going on in the state about this right now.
And I think anybody that actually does kind of a deep dive into this would agree with that. Like, yeah, short answer, yes. But there is a lot of complications.
There are. And I'd also like to say, you know, I've written things about it. I wouldn't say what I've written is a paper. You know, in my world now, when we talk about papers, we're talking about, can we publish things? You know, I've put my thoughts together on these things. You know, and look, I think that we had a short session. It was a budget session. There was a lot going on. And I don't know that, I don't believe the bill got the attention that it deserved. And when I look at this, we're looking at the state that is trying to do something that is generally unpopular, you know, and we have to do it right. Mm-hmm. Like somebody said to me, well, I think we should just pass it and then we can fix it later. No, we have to get it right the first time.
It has to stand.
Right.
Like one of the things that just kills me, especially, you know, with the 2A community is, you know, we have to do it right, no matter what it is, whether it's training, whether it is the way we carry, the discipline we hold ourselves to, holding other people accountable to not being, you know, responsible in their gun ownership and responsible in their training and responsible in taking ownership of the weight that all this carries. And every time we don't do that, we give the anti-Second Amendment community ammunition.
Yep.
And we cannot, you know, yeah, do I think gun-free zones keep anybody safe? No, I don't. You know, I think that they are clearly a target for people who want to hurt others, you know. But if we're going to take this blanket off of things, we've got to take the blanket off correctly.
Right.
I couldn't agree more.
Yep.
And after reading the bill and the governor's response as to why he did what he did, while I agree with the concept the bill was written for,
yep.
The way the bill was actually worded when it was finally submitted to the governor had problems.
No, and there was one line in the governor's response that really really stuck with me, and it was that he wasn't vetoing this on the basis of what the bill stood for, but that he wanted it done with more transparency, and I think he was exactly right, because when I read it, there was so much convoluted and contradictory language in the bill that I think a much cleaner bill he probably would have signed it.
You know, and I, you know, I won't speculate on whether he will. I haven't read his notes. I know that you all have, and I love that. I think that people need to do a better job of deep diving into the substance of things and deep diving into why decisions are being made, mm-hmm. instead of the knee-jerk, emotional reaction to, oh, I want gun-free zones gone. Okay. But
you got to read the bill.
In what way? Yeah. You've got to read the bill.
Mm-hmm. And you have to actually take the time to read it and understand what's being said. Because on its face, I was in total agreement with the bill. But when I really started reading into it and reading the language and the way that it was written, I had some reservations.
The bill was written in a way of gun-free zones are not good from a constitutional perspective.
Right.
But the methods in which they were applying getting rid of them, it wasn't good for litigation.
No.
It wasn't good for law to be written on it in the way that they wrote. So it removed the emotion from it and have a process forward that makes sense.
Right.
I didn't see that from the bill.
No.
I didn't either. And an attorney that I know, we were talking about other laws. We were having a discussion about another law that is ambiguous. And one of the lines he used that I really like is that laws say what they say. They don't say what they don't say. And we can't read this bill and make it say what we want it to say.
Right.
It says what it says, you know, and it doesn't say what it doesn't say. And there are inconsistencies in there. There are conflicts. I think there's conflicts with other laws that, you know, the way, because they didn't just add a statute. They changed other statutes. They
right.
changed the verbiage in other statutes that, as I interpret it, creates problems for the concealed carry permitting process,
right.
you know, that we need. You know, yes, we're a constitutional carry state, but if you're going to travel outside the state and you want to carry, you have to have a permit to even carry in those reciprocity states.
Yep, you're exactly right. And
whether you agree with that or not, that's the law.
That's the law.
That's one of the things that really hangs me up is people talk about, you know, one of the worst arguments I hear from the 2A community is they just say, shall not be infringed. Okay, what shall not be infringed? Tell me. Tell me what the verbiage of the Second Amendment truly means. Tell me. Shall not be infringed means nothing. If you cannot tell me what shall not be infringed means.
Well, and so this is where I'm going to climb back into my purist standpoint. The Second Amendment was very well written. It is very clear. And to go along to get along, we've allowed infringements based on the public good that are infringements, straight up. Shall not be infringed means that you shall make no law that hampers the ability of the American people to carry, to own, to possess firearms. And in the context of when it's written, we're talking about folks that just came through a war with the largest military force on the planet at the time that wanted to take the civilian firearms away so they can control them from a military's perspective. Shall not be infringed means it's a limitation on government. You don't have jurisdiction over this. And we've allowed it over the years.
And while I agree with the premise there, I disagree. I think it's horribly written. I think the language in it is convoluted. It's not clear. Like, they could have used much clearer language. They did not. You know, and this is a problem with the writing styles of the 1800s, the 1700s. I mean, the language was, you know, compared to today, I mean, it's just not good, you know? And, you know, I think that Justice Scalia did a great job of exploring the meaning of the Second Amendment in D.C. versus Heller. If you have not read that case, go read the case. You know, don't just read and go with the, oh, this is what the court held. Go read the case. That case is one of the best opinions I've read in law school. And his the way he defines the Second Amendment is really good. He goes into the historical context and deep dives into, okay, what did the drafters mean? How were these words used back then? And really dissects it. And I think that he did a great job. He breaks down every clause of the amendment. And look, I agree that that's the premise of the amendment. But unfortunately, the language is not as clear as it could be. You know, the First Amendment's much better written than the Second Amendment is. And you know, so it was there. The Constitution's pretty clear. You know, you go read the articles. I don't think that there's a part where I've read through, you know, different articles of the Constitution where what are they talking about? You know, but you read the Second Amendment, and they've got several different clauses, you know, lacking transitions. You know, it's just, it's there. And I think that Scalia got it there. I think that Justice Scalia did a great job of putting the language of the Second Amendment from the time of drafting into words that people can understand every day. And I encourage every listener, go read the case. You know, if you haven't read Bruin, go read Bruin. If you haven't read McDonald, go read McDonald. Go read these cases. Don't just be the guy who says, oh, well, they said this. Understand why. Read the case. Understand the arguments that the justice has made. Those are as important as the holding, because you have to understand the why.
Very well said.
I couldn't say it better myself. I mean, at the end of the day, everybody's got to go do their own research, and they got to understand it.
They rights do. Come with responsibility.
That's right. And yeah, I mean, that's something I've been saying for years. It shouldn't have been the Bill of Rights. It should have been the Bill of Responsibility. Because as citizens, we do have responsibilities. Yes, they're enumerated rights, but with those rights comes responsibility. And for you guys, you know, I want to thank James for coming on and talking to us about all this stuff. But at the end of the day, it's your responsibility, and you can't keep blaming the gun.